This week, I sit down with our regular guest, Julia, and we dive into the ever-evolving world of baby Aurelia. At 10 months old, she is facing teething, developmental leaps, and some sleepless nights, which is leaving Julia exhausted. But don't worry, we've got some practical solutions to get everyone back on track. So what are you going to learn from this amazing episode? First of all, we are going to crack the sleep code. I'm going to talk about how illness, teething, and naps can be affecting your baby's sleep, and that there are simple adjustments that you can make that really will make all the difference. We also go through milestones and comparisons, and we look at how every baby develops completely differently and how actually slowing down milestones can actually set them up for success. If it sounds counterintuitive, you do need to listen. Julia opens up about her work-life balance, and it's just an amazing kind of enlightened conversation for any mom who's battling with work-life balance at the moment, for those working mums. And then right at the beginning of the episode, you'll hear us get into the school system and how to choose schools for little ones and the differences between private schools, expensive education, and actually choosing something that really fits your little one. So if that's a conversation that interests you, that's something you really don't want to miss. And we talk a lot around how listening to your gut is really important in these decision-making processes. So whether you are knee-deep in sleepless nights, debating milestone timelines, or you are navigating the schooling maze, this episode is packed with expert insights and real talk and sense from one mom to another. Tune in now.
Welcome to Sense by Meg Forer, the podcast that's brought to you by ParentSense, the app that takes guesswork out of parenting. If you're a new parent, then you are in good company. Your host, Meg Forer, is a well-known OT, infant specialist, and the author of 8 parenting books. Each week, we're going to spend time with new mums and dads just like you to chat about the week's wins, the challenges, and the questions of the moment. Subscribe to the podcast, download the ParentSense app, and catch Meg here every week to make the most of that first year of your little one's life. And now, meet your host.
Welcome back, mums and dads, to Sense by Meg Forer. And today we have our regular guest, Julia, with us. Julia is mum to 2 little ones, Santi, who is almost 4, I cannot believe, and tiny little Aurelia, who's not as tiny as she used to be. She is now nearly 10 months old, so 42 weeks old. But welcome back, Julia. Lovely to have you.
Thank you, Meg. I know I've said it before, but every time you describe me as a mom of 2, I'm like, who are you talking about?
But at night when you get into bed, I bet you feel like you're a mom of 5.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
It is exhausting, isn't it? Especially that 4-year-old. It's a hell of a journey, that one.
Yeah, he actually turned 4 yesterday. We had his party over the weekend. Yeah, thank you. It's always a funny time. I'm sure other mums have this as well. You get a bit like sentimental and nostalgic. And, you know, I spend half an hour scrolling back in my phone looking at all the pictures of him when he was born. And Vita and I actually lay in bed together last night looking at old photos of him. And oh, it's just, yeah, it's crazy how time flies. That whole thing about, you know, the days being long and the years being short is so true. I mean, in my case, the nights were long too. But it's, yeah, I don't know. Oh, gosh. So it brings up a lot of feelings and a lot of thinking about how different they are.
Yeah, and it's such an interesting age because, you know, until 4 years old, they are, and this is what I experienced with my kids and I've seen it with other people as well, they often feel so much like they are the center of the world. Their confidence is high. They're taking risks. They're not thinking about the future or about consequences. And, you know, I've often looked back on my youngest, and she's a very introspective child. I mean, she's 19, so she's not a child anymore. But and she will often talk about, she wonders when it was that she lost her, like, her confidence to just go out there and be anything, do anything. And when I look back at pictures of her, I feel like it was somewhere around about this age, you know, that the world kind of suddenly becomes a reality and you almost want to protect them from that and make sure that they still feel invincible for their whole lives. You know, it's a very interesting age.
Yeah, it is. And it's funny because, you know, the last few weeks actually is the first time that I've noticed him doing any kind of acting out, whether it's to do with Aurelia or not, I don't know. It might be coincidental, for example, with her starting to crawl. We sort of have to focus on her a bit more than perhaps we had to before, because, you know, we try and make sure she doesn't kill herself. So there's a sort of diversion of attention there. The reality is he gets so much one-on-one attention, more than her, if I'm completely frank. I mean, she's quite self-sufficient and looks after herself. We do much more, you know, directly with him. But I think he does start to sort of feel the lack of attention a bit now. And certainly over his birthday weekend, when he was the center of attention, he was a much happier little boy. So sort of was making me think about that a bit as well. And, oh, how to manage it. But I mean, isn't it just like it's the constant juggle?
Yeah. And it's so interesting you say that, because I've always felt when you talk about Santi that my experience with my firstborn, James, and he was my only boy, my eldest, was very similar to Santi in many respects. Like it felt like an annihilation that first year. I had to work hard. He was busy. What just wasn't as easy. And my second little one is just like Aurelia. She's to this day is the most chilled, laid back, kind of just a pleasure to be around, where James was quite a lot of hard work. I mean, he's exceptional. And so I do think that, you know, people who are exceptional later in life come with a lot of busyness, curiosity, mischievousness, kind of pushing boundaries when they're little. And James certainly did do that. But I can remember at around about 4 years old saying to my husband, I think he should have just been an only child. Like he might have just been happier because he loves his sister. But gee, he was, you know, he's always been the center of the world for himself, you know, so, and he's wanted that from everything else. So it's very interesting to watch how their personalities progress. And I think also the schools you choose for your kids, and you know, I've often said this, and there are very few things in life that I wish I could turn back the clock on, but one of them is potentially the schools that I chose for my kids in the primary school years. Cause I think that the school system can really stifle that human spirit. I think it's problematic. The primary school system, high school, not as much, but the primary school system is a cookie cutter approach that sticks everybody into a mold. And I just feel like, you know, with this human spirit, you need to be so careful about not squashing it.
Yeah. It's so interesting that you say that, because it's something I think about so much. You know, it was a different time, but I reflect back on my school experience. I think I've alluded to the fact before that my birth was quite problematic for my brother, my twin brother. So he had what was called in the 80s learning disabilities. What sort of came out in the wash was that he actually just learned very differently and very atypically from the traditional kind of education setup, certainly in this country and certainly in the 80s and 90s. He went on to become the most highly qualified person in our family, which is incredibly ironic. You know, he went and got a degree while the rest of us, you know, were much more higher diploma and dropping out of varsity types. But at the time they tried to keep him back in first grade. And my parents went and looked at some schools that kind of were designed for children with disabilities and with learning challenges. And the children at those schools were genuinely, you know, troubled. And my mom and dad really felt like that wasn't the case. And anyway, long story short, he landed up staying in a completely traditional school and not thriving, but managing and getting through. And he had extra tutoring and so on. But it was very much the structure of that system that I think really held him back. Whereas I was naturally kind of academic and I found school very easy and straightforward and kind of sailed through, and I was quite social. And so it does make me think a lot about that exact thing of how do you determine what's right for your child? You know, how do you even know when you're sending them into first grade if this is a school that's going to suit them, and how do you monitor that? It's the whole thing is quite complex, to be honest.
Yeah. And I mean, it kind of comes around to listening to your own gut feelings about these things. Not that we can always hear our gut, because sometimes the science is so overwhelming and the noise is so noisy that we can't even hear what our gut is. But I mean, I do remember when James was very little, I put him into a play group just down the road from us. We lived in Nurtuk, and it was small. There were only 15 kids in the school, and he screamed and cried and held onto me every single morning. And he cried, was still seemed to be crying when I picked him up. And after about 2 months of that, I decided this is not working. And that's when I started the first play set school, actually, which was six children. I approached five of my friends, and I said, come, like-minded people, I'll hire an au pair, I'll give her a program, and we'll homeschool our children in my home. And then I did it for James and Alex and Emily. And to this day, all three of them look back on their play sense days as the most wonderful experience. And they all had that until they went to formal school, which was grade R in those days. The sad thing is that so many people now are sticking their children into formal schooling settings at a very young age, and also into schools that are so outcomes driven for primary school that there is only one measure of what is success, and you know, and that for me, I have a real problem. I think education is failing our kids, and you know, so to be able to listen to your gut feeling, I did listen to my gut on that preschool. I didn't listen to my gut on the primary school, because there was this thing of, you know, we need to get our children into the Bishops and Herschels and the private schools in primary school, otherwise they won't get into high school. I mean, my biggest piece of advice to any mum who's listening, who's feeling this pressure to get your kids into a private school system in primary school, is don't do it. Like, it's a waste of money, and it's expensive, and they will get in when they get to high school. You know, high school is a different story, because high school is your exit into university. You need to have a certain grounding, but primary school, actually, the best thing that they can have is quite a bit of free time, very little homework, and just the foundations being done through, you know, an engaging teacher and an engaging curriculum, you know. So, yeah, I mean, you really do need to listen to your inner voice when it comes to primary schools, I think.
Yeah, you are absolutely speaking my language. And it's funny, because I really am going against the current with that. That's exactly how I plan to approach their schooling. Because I watch so many of my friends with kids that are a little bit older than Santi, or even actually children who are Santi's age, who have been swept into grade N and grade R in private schools because the parents are terrified they're not going to get them in. And then they're going to be in that private school system from, you know, the age of three until matric at 18. And I'm just, A, that's an obscene amount of money, and B, I'm not playing that game. Like, there are absolutely fantastic public schools near us. We're very lucky to have them. The kids can go there for junior school, be exposed to all sorts of different people from different backgrounds and different cultures, and learn about the real world. And then, you know, like you say, they can have their formalized education from, you know, grade eight. I think that's more than enough for them. But there is absolutely a machine at work that is trying to catch these kids, and, you know, at this very, very young age, and suck them into the system. And I think, you know, my plan is to buck that as much as I can.
Yeah. And I mean, talking about that machine, I mean, we're getting into all sorts of deep stuff here, but there are two machines. The one is a commercial machine, which is that education companies have realized that they can monetize this and be hugely profitable. And profit means you need to have as many heads in at the highest price possible, and then that's basically your revenue. And so yes, that machine pushes you from earlier and earlier. I mean, I can remember when one of the big school groups in South Africa started, under the same name of their school, a nursery. When I talk about that, like I think for 4-month-olds, and they in fact shut down because they managed to get 30 newborns in hospital just about with a rotavirus of some sort. I think it was rotavirus time or RSV. I can't remember. But it was really like, it was exactly case in point. Little babies are not supposed to be in big classrooms. So that's the first agenda, is of course the commercial agenda. And the second agenda actually is what feeds on parents' fears, which is that there's this education system that is like, this is the only route to success in the world. And I mean, we know that this is not to be true, but it plays on our fears because we think, gosh, if my child falls behind at 4 years old, then surely they're never going to catch up or never going to get in, and they're never going to, you know, get that PhD. But I love the story about your brother, because unconventional has more degrees than the rest of you, you know, so it's not a measure of success. Not that a degree anyway is a measure of success, but
I suppose we could go on forever about that topic, but it's a very hot topic, I think, for people with children my children's ages, because we are at this crunch point where people are having to make a decision. And you know, I do think that it's parents are so vulnerable at this stage, and they just want to do the best for their kids. And unfortunately, you know, I might be cynical, but I think that there are people who prey on those vulnerabilities, unfortunately, and maybe a system that does, whether it's, you know, wittingly or not. But anyway, so yeah, these are the conversations I'm having with the other moms.
Absolutely. So interesting. And if we like kind of rewind in life back to the life of a 9-10 month old, how is Aurelia doing?
This episode is brought to us by ParentSense, the all-in-one baby and parenting app that helps you make the most of your baby's first year. Don't you wish someone would just tell you everything you need to know about caring for your baby? When to feed them, how to wean them, and why they won't sleep?
ParentSense app is like having a baby expert on your phone guiding you to parent with confidence. Get a flexible routine, daily tips, and advice personalized for you and your little one. Download ParentSense app now from your app store and take the guesswork out of parenting.
And if we like kind of rewind in life back to the life of a 9-10 month old, how is Aurelia doing?
Oh, I'm very tired. we've had a kind of unfortunate confluence of events, I suppose. I'm not necessarily 100% sure what it all is, but I suspect it's a combination of illness. So she's been sick pretty much consecutively since the last time we spoke, with some version of a cold. I mean, a lot of people talk about, and I know certainly for adults, we're all getting these viruses that we're struggling to get rid of completely. Certainly they take a long time to, you know, for coughs to clear and things like that. And I think it's something like that with her, when she's had a little bit of a cold and it hasn't really cleared properly. And then she's been hit with some other kind of little virus. And they were both man down on Sunday with temperatures and not feeling 100%, not terribly sick, but not great. So her nights have been disrupted because of that. So managing temperatures and having snotty noses and perhaps being in a bit of pain. The mouth has been absolutely pouring, so I suspect there's perhaps another tooth on the horizon. She also is going through a developmental leap, essentially, because she's kind of busy transitioning from crawling to walking. She's pushing her walker along the ground. She loves that. It was actually funny because what it was making me think of was how different Santi and Aurelia are as babies. And I don't know if it's as simple as just boys versus girls. It may be partly to do with that. But I remember when he was crawling, he could not be stopped. He just wanted to motor around the house from the minute he learned how to crawl. He was just rushing around the house. Whereas her main motivation for crawling is to crawl to something she can pull up on so that she can stand and bounce or potentially push it around. So she's not quite as busy, I suppose, as he was. And that's one of the things that I noticed. It's quite interesting. I mean, it's quite nice for me. But she's very much wanting to, you know, stand up in the cot and stand up in the bath and, you know, is getting quite dangerous. So there's just lots and lots going on. And I think that the elements of that are all kind of playing into not great amounts of sleep. And I think the last time we spoke, we'd been struggling with very early morning wakings. And kind of as I predicted, those were replaced quite quickly by all of this stuff. And it's been a combination of night wakings and sometimes going down quite badly at bedtime and us struggling with that a bit. So yeah, it's been just a lot of disruption, and it really starts to add up after a while.
Yeah, so very interesting. And before I jump in, because I've got quite a few things that I'd like to give you as tips and a few other ideas as well. But before I do, when you're talking about bad sleep, can you just sketch what her day and night sleep currently looks like?
So she's up for the day around 6 normally, and then her first nap is usually 8:30, maybe 9 o'clock. That nap, unless it's disrupted by something like pain or fever, it's normally about an hour and a half. When she's like, now she's been sick, it's been more like 2 hours, but that's not really normal. And then she has another nap kind of around lunchtime or just after lunchtime, normally about sort of 12:30. And she'll sleep for, I normally try and get her up after an hour max. And then she goes down for bed at between 6 and 6:30 normally. And she goes down to the day naps usually okay. Like I say, unless she's kind of feeling unwell, she normally does sleep nicely.
And is she fighting bedtime?
A couple of times she has, literally 2 or 3 times in the last 3 weeks, but largely bedtime she's pretty good at. She'll go down quite nicely. And what we struggle with is if she does wake in the night, if, you know, it used to be, you know, more than a few weeks ago that she would just have a little bit of water and normally kind of go straight back to sleep, or she was sleeping through. At the moment, it's a bit more of a struggle to get her down. Or we've had some nights where she's like wide awake, it's time to party, bounce, 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 wants our attention. And we have to like try and sit in the room with like my back to her, trying not to make eye contact. We're not playing, it's bedtime now. So that can take like an hour to get her to go back to sleep. So that's a little bit of a nightmare. So yeah, it's a sort of mixed bag.
And how many times is she awake at night?
Usually one. But last night was like three times, but I don't think she was happy last night. I think she was still feeling a bit sick. So normally I would say it's once. That's, yeah. But it just, I suppose it's the degree of effort it takes to get her back down that can vary.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's break it down into four different buckets in terms of sleep. So I always like to look at the basic needs. I like to look at the sensory. I like to look at the developmental, and then also, of course, the habits. So, I mean, in each of those buckets, the absolute basic needs are always the most important thing to rule out. And you've mentioned the illness, and that can definitely have a bearing. So that would be the first place that I would start. And, you know, often when little ones have had a snotty nose, they actually get what's called glue ear, which is basically the fluid from the nose, which is really liquidy and mucousy when it's fresh, filters when they're lying down, filters down through the eustachian tubes into the inner ear. And then what ends up happening is that it thickens up and it becomes gunky and it can't flow back out. And so while it's not an infection, it's what we call glue ear. So it's just a congestion in the ears, and it actually causes pressure behind the eardrums, which then actually wake them up. So very first thing.
She's been pulling on her ears, Meg. That's very useful.
Yes. So the very first thing I would look at, and you don't even need a doctor's appointment. I mean, most pharmacies have got somebody who can look with a stethoscope, an ear thing inside the ears, and they just look for a little light reflex bouncing off the tympanum, off the eardrum, and then they can say to you, this is glue ear or not. And then it's as simple as sorting it out with a little nasal decongestant, which we don't like to use in little babies or for too long, but otherwise some saline solution. And so I would definitely start off there. So just get those ears clear and make sure, particularly if she's having that, you know, those long patches of waking or lots of wakings. Also, currently rife in South Africa is foot and mouth disease. So that's the Coxsackie virus. And it's, you know, I heard it on the news the other day and I was like, why are they announcing how many cases of Coxsackie virus there are? Because every kid gets it. I'm sure every year thousands of children have it. But now there's this announcement on the radio that X amount of children have got Coxsackie virus, like it's measles. I don't know. It's not dangerous. It does cause some irritability. They get they kind of get miserable for a while, and then these little almost like little sores come out on the soles of their hands, blisters that come out of their soles and their hands, and then also blisters in their mouth. And often if they're drooling a lot, that can be something. So worth just checking out. Nothing you can do about it. It is a virus, but it also could be. So
that I suspect that's exactly what Santi had. And in fact, it probably makes sense that he gave it to her as well. So, okay, right. First two out the box, you got it. You got it, mate.
All right, definitely worth checking out the basics. Always kick off there, especially, you know, and moms listening to you and following your journey have known that Aurelia is a very easy baby. And when we get easy babies and they disrupt themselves, 9 out of 10 times it's going to be health. And they'll do it because they will get disrupted by health and because, you know, they're miserable and whatever. But yeah, just treat it symptomatically, maybe see somebody and get those two sorted out. Also fitting into the basic needs is nutrition, of course. And another thing just with this age children is that you want to make sure they're getting enough iron, because their iron stores from birth disappear by 6 months. Unless they're on a fortified cereal or a formula, they're probably not getting additional iron. And so it needs to be given to them in a good, wholesome diet, which means red meat, leafy vegetables, dark green veggies, that type of thing. So I would definitely be having a look at your, and what's quite a nice thing to get that in is there's a recipe inside the Weaning Sense book, which has spinach and quinoa in it as the savouries. And then as the sweet, it's got the berry and banana. And it is just a fabulous smoothie. They love drinking it. And because it's got the vitamin C with the berries and the iron in the spinach, it's a really good way to get your iron stores in, your iron nutrition in a natural way as well. Otherwise, you can pop onto Floridix Liquid Iron, which is a nice, soft iron supplement, which also works well. So that would be the nutrition piece that I would definitely be taking care of. Then moving on into just a little bit around sleeps. There are two times when we get a sleep regression associated with too much sleep in the day. The one is at 9 months and the other one is at 12 months. And the reason is that at 9 months, they need to drop to two sleeps, and at 12 months, they need to drop, or 12 to 14 months, they need to drop to one sleep. Now, she has dropped to two sleeps, but she's having quite a lot. On a day that she has a 2-hour morning and more than an hour lunchtime, she probably will wake up at night because she's effectively getting a good 3 hours during the day. The classic amount that we would normally expect from 9 months, and she's now 10 months onwards, would be and you don't have to stick to the times, but we would be looking for 45 minutes in the morning and a maximum of an hour to an hour and a half in the afternoon. They can swing it around the other way. So they can do 90 minutes in the morning and 45 in the afternoon. But if she's had a good 90 to 2 hours in the morning, I would probably wake her after 45 or an hour in the afternoon and see if that helps. So just pull back those day sleeps a little bit. And moms, if you're listening and you're still on 3 day sleeps between 9 and 10 months, definitely drop that late afternoon sleep. Your little one will be fighting it anyway, but it is worth dropping it because that can also interfere. And then in terms of the sensory, one of the things that I definitely think is that they need a lot of vestibular input. And what's interesting, and that's movement input in the afternoon, what's interesting with those little ones who don't love to crawl and get up on their legs, what they're often doing is they're bouncing quite a bit and they're almost seeking that proprioception. So you want to make sure she's getting lots of proprioception and lots of vestibular as well. So popping her on a swing in the late afternoon would also be a really good idea. And then your developmental leaps. She has got two that she is going through. The one is that she is now progressing through a milestone. So either becoming a swift crawler or moving on into practicing walking definitely interferes, and nothing you can do about that. Though that is one of the sleep things that you just have to bide your time and move through. But the other one that is classic at this age is separation anxiety, where they just want to know that you're there. So they call you back because they want to make sure that you still exist when they can't see you. And for that, it would be playing lots of separation games in the day, lots of peekaboo, crawling behind the couch and calling her to find you, always saying goodbye. So if you leave the house, leave the room, don't try and sneak out, say goodbye. And I always say with moms who are working or having to leave, like you're going to go and fetch Santi from school, always start with very small increments. So say goodbye to her and go down the passage and come back 5 minutes later. So she starts to associate a separation with a reunion quite quickly while it's still in her mind. And then when you have an extended time, like 45 minutes to go and fetch Santi or 5 hours because you're at work, you then, she then understands that you do come back when she doesn't see you. So those are just some of the absolute basics. And then other than that, it's all the behavioral stuff. So she doesn't need any sleep training for certain. I would just be going through these steps. But for moms who've got habits, like their baby's being fed to sleep or rocked to sleep or waking for 15 dummies, they would then need to do the behavioral. So that's kind of sleep sense in 5 minutes. There you go.
Mm, yeah. All such good advice. I've actually even been writing it down. I find myself that often, you know, we record these episodes and they come out a few weeks later. And by the time I then listen to them again, and I think, completely forgot about that thing that Meg told me, I really must do that. So now I'm taking notes because I know that by the time I listen back to this, I'll be like, oh, I wish I'd remembered that at the time. It would have made my life so much easier.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, hopefully you'll get that sleep sorted quite quickly. And that's the good news, is that first of all, good sleepers return to be good sleepers. And second of all, any mom who's worked at sleep once can just go back to those principles again. And they almost become life skills for you and for your little one, but life skills for you to be able to deal with the next sleep hiccup, which of course will happen again.
Mm, exactly. Yeah. And it's as the gift of having, you know, of being on your next child, your second or third child, is I think that you really do know that kids move through these phases really quickly. Whereas in your first child, you think you're going to die in the moment at 4 o'clock in the morning when you've been awake for 2 hours and you think, this is going to kill me. It's much easier to have a little bit of perspective, even though, you know, that's not to say it's not tough at the time, but it is easier.
Yeah. And that's so interesting because I think often when people are a little bit judgy on social media to say, they're little for so short, don't spoil, you know, don't worry about spoiling them, like, you know, break all the rules. But they don't understand that actually when I'm the mom at the rock face, I do actually need some sort of normality. You know, they say, don't worry if they wake up 15 times and I just get up for them. It'll be over in a couple of years. Well, you feel like I might not survive.
I'll be dead by then.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, so absolutely.
I feel your pain.
It's enough to incite an extreme amount of rage. Yeah, that whole narrative, I must say, I wholeheartedly reject. It's the idea that you should somehow in the sort of thick of night when you've been doing this for 10 months in a row, somehow find some miraculous gratitude that is going to make you not feel absolutely exhausted is just entirely absurd. So moms, if you are also absolutely knackered and you really don't like your baby in the middle of the night, I think that's normal. normal. And it's okay, because the thing I always tell myself is tomorrow is another day. When I spend a night when I am just exhausted and I can't stand my child, or I end up shouting at Santi about something I shouldn't have, I just tell myself that tomorrow is a chance to try again and do better. That's the only thing you can do.
Exactly, 100%, absolutely. And other things, tell us what else is going on, because I was just quickly popping into the app, the ParentSense app, and I have Aurelia's profile on my app. And one of the things for today is that the developmental outcome for the period is pointing with a finger. Has she started pointing with a finger? Like if you put some Cheerios or peas down, will she start to scratch at them or point?
She, not exactly, although the other day I was, you know, sort of ET phone home thing, like I was pointing my finger at her, then she would touch her fingertip to mine, and sort of, I think that's kind of maybe the first step towards getting her to point, to kind of be aware of her fingertip. So I suppose we're getting there. She is doing a lot of kind of mimicry, I suppose. So the other day also I was feeding her, and I'm making a funny noise with my mouth, and she sort of looked at me with these big eyes, and then she went and did it straight back at me. It was so cute. So there's a lot of that kind of thing going on, which is really sweet. And it just feels like every day she's learning some new funny noise to make or gesture to make. I've been trying to teach her, as I've been feeding her, a kind of a sign for all done, which is something that I did with Santi. And, you know, funny, I know that this is going to sound like an insane thing to say, and it's probably just like my, you know, slightly biased mothering instinct. But when I was saying to her last night, doing the kind of gesture of shrugging and putting my hands up and saying, all done. And she literally just went, all done. I was like, what? I'm like, Titi, she just spoke to me. Of course, she didn't do it again after that, but maybe I hallucinated the whole thing. But there's some kind of mirror neurons firing, I'm convinced.
No, you definitely do get it. And those are some of my favorite videos that you can actually find on YouTube, where a baby way before the talking age actually mimics the word so closely that it actually, you know that they were actually trying to say that. I mean, there's a video of a gorgeous little girl. She's 4 months old, sitting on her dad's lap. And he says, I love you. I love you. And he keeps repeating, I love you. And then she says, I love you. I mean, she's 4 months old. She's clearly not saying I love you. That's a three-word sentence. But it was just like, and I've watched it so many times because I use it for teaching purposes when I'm teaching my therapists. And it is amazing. But what she was doing was, of course, first of all, serve and return, which is taking a turn and responding. And second of all, yeah, that imitation of sounds, not necessarily words. And yeah, she won't do it again for a while potentially, but that was definitely her talking. I think she's genius.
I mean, I have to agree with you. There's no doubt in my mind that she's not only the most beautiful baby in existence, but also the smartest baby in existence. Although Titi does keep saying to me, she's very, very smart, because she keeps talking about all the kind of serve and return that she lands up being with her in the day. And the fact that she's, my mother-in-law tells me that my husband started walking at 9 months, which I don't believe for one second. But now that I've actually seen it in action, when, you know, she is really actually quite close to walking, I can see how that actually is a possibility. You know, whereas Santi was much more, you know, on the nose of 12 months he started walking. But they always say girls are a little bit quicker in their development as well, so maybe it's that as well.
Well, I'll tell you something very interesting. So it's very interesting that you say that, because my firstborn did actually walk at 9 months. Kids definitely do it. And at the time I was like, this kid is going to be a springbok something, because he's clearly, his gross motor skills are so advanced. What actually transpired was, I mean, he was walking by 9 months, running by 10 months, impossible. I mean, it was the most like frightening experience of my life to have this very underage child with no boundaries, you know, so stable and running. But what actually happened was his gross motor milestones later on were not as good as other children. And actually, he will even tell you that he was very uncoordinated. He never was a fabulous swimmer, cricket player. And there's a reason for that. And that is that the longer children take with foundational milestones, the more they consolidate for later on. And so you actually find, and I mean, bizarre story, but my sister's middle child only walked at 18 months. I mean, literally 18 months. I was starting to panic. You know, inside myself, because I was like, I know this can be normal, but now he's my nephew. So now actually, you know, everything I tell mom suddenly takes on another meaning. But he is going to probably be a Springbok. He is the most coordinated cricketer imaginable. He goes on international cricket tours already, and he's not even 11. But the point is that consolidation of milestones is very important. So when you were talking, I actually wrote it down because you said to me right at the beginning of the conversation that Santi crawled for forever, or very fast and speedily, and that was his mode of locomotion. And of course, Aurelia is not doing that as fast, as much, and is getting up onto her feet quickly. And you probably will find, and I'd love to touch base with you in 4 years' time, that he actually is more coordinated than she is long term. And so it's one of those illustrations that I often use to say to moms, don't try and rush those milestones, because slow consolidation bears way more fruit later on than swiftly moving through things and not getting it consolidated properly. And there is neuroscience to actually support that as well.
Well, there's a part of me that's quite, I mean, it's probably an entirely sexist thing to say, but I'm quite relieved that that bodes well for Santi's sporting career. Aurelia's going to be beautiful. She doesn't need to be a Springbok.
She is beautiful.
That's what I tell myself. I wasn't particularly coordinated either. I was actually asked my mom when I started walking. She's here. I'll ask her now, because that would be very, very interesting. I was actually asking her about the two of us and how our milestones compared, actually. So I'm sure that's kind of fascinating too.
Very interesting. Well, we have touched on everything. I mean, we've really touched on a wide range of things, especially in the long-term journey of a child. You know, I loved our conversation around education. And a lot of what we've spoken about is actually spoken to slowing down as well. You know, like not necessarily putting yourself, your baby, your life on a roller coaster, and rather just actually going through the consolidation and getting a good match for your little ones. So
I know we've spoken a lot about the challenges of being a working mom, and I certainly struggled last year with finding a balance of any kind. And I did say that I was going to make some progress around trying to pull back on work a bit, and I have over the last month. And I can't actually tell you what a huge difference it's made to have. I've basically got an extra set of hands to help me at work now. And the difference in my capacity as a parent, let alone the other, you know, changes to my mood and the stress levels and so on, has been quite profound. So, you know, you're talking about slowing down. I really do. I'm a huge advocate for that. I couldn't do it last year. The system wasn't set up for me, but now I feel like I can, and it's in place, and it's hugely beneficial. So yeah, here's the slowing down.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a wonderful book that I read many years ago now, and it was one of my favorite books at the time. And I used it to inform some of the work I did at PlaySense. But the book was called In Praise of Slow. And it spoke about child development as well as the rest of our lives. And it really is a book that's worth getting your hands on. And and hats off to you, because sometimes slowing down is really hard. I mean, I recently had to do it with a team member of mine where I could see the wheels were falling off in her home life. And I said to her, you know what, you are going to need to just take a little bit of a breather for a couple of months, not leave work or anything, but just take a lower load. And I hope it will bear fruit for her, because I think a lot of people feel like, oh, you know, if I take my foot off the pedal, I'm going to go backwards. But actually, you're still moving. You're just not necessarily as frenetic as you were. So maybe you're consolidating, which is a good thing.
Yeah. And, you know, again, it does come back to privilege. I'm lucky enough that by taking my foot off the gas, you know, I have had to have conversations with Vito about what that means from a financial perspective for us. And it's okay. It's manageable. Certainly for the time being, not everybody has that privilege. But, it, you know, I suppose it isn't necessarily also always just about that. There are other ways to find presence of mind, to find time, to make time. I do believe in that. You know, we talk about busyness in the society a lot, and it has been historically overvalued. I think now that the balance is shifting, but I do think that there are lots of ways to make time for things that are important, like rest, like connection. So it just takes effort, and it takes some decision making.
And sometimes it's not as much about privilege as it is about priorities. And somebody recently said to me, you need to think about how much is enough, because we're always, you know, what is your priority and what is the cost? And amazing to you for doing that, because I think there'll be a lot of moms who're sitting listening to this thinking, gosh, I know that I'm just holding on a knife's edge. So maybe it is time to slow down a bit. Yeah. Wonderful. Thanks, Julie. I really appreciate the chat, and we will do it again.
Cool. Thanks, Meg. See you next time.
Cheers.
Thanks to everyone who joined us. We will see you the same time next week. Until then, download ParentSense app and take the guesswork out of parenting.